So let me begin with the definition of a state, a rather uncontroversial definition. What must an agent be able to do in order to qualify as a state? This agent must be able to insist that all conflicts among the inhabitants of some given territory be brought to him for ultimate decision making or be subject to his final review. And in particular, this agent must be able to insist that all conflicts involving himself be adjudicated by him or his agent. And implied in the power to exclude all others from acting as ultimate judge, that is, as a second defining characteristic of a state, is the agent's power to tax, that is, to unilaterally determine the price that any justice seeker must pay for his services. Now, based on this definition of the state, it is easy to understand why a desire to control a state might exist. For whoever is a monopolist of final arbitration within a given territory can make laws, and he who can legislate can also tax. And surely this is an enviable position to be in. It's not difficult to explain why states come into existence. More difficult to understand is how anyone can get away with controlling a state. Why would others put up with such an institution? And I want to approach the answer to this question indirectly. Suppose you and your friends happen to be in control of such an extraordinary institution. What would you do to maintain your position, provided that you didn't have any moral scruples against this institution in the first place? You would certainly use some of your tax income to hire some thugs. First, to make peace among your subjects so that they stay productive and there is something to tax in the future. But more importantly, because you might need these thugs for your own protection should the people wake up from their dogmatic slumber and challenge you in your position. Now, this will not do, however. In particular, if you and your friends are a small minority in comparison with the number of your subjects, testing me rule the majority solely by brute force. It must rule by opinion. This is one of the great discoveries of David Hume. The majority of the population must be brought to voluntarily accept your rule. This is not to say that the majority must agree with every one of your measures. Indeed, it may well believe that many of your policies are mistaken. However, it must believe in the legitimacy of the institution of a state as such, and hence that even if a particular policy may be wrong, such mistake is just an accident that one must tolerate in view of some greater good provided by the state. Yet how can one persuade the majority of the population to believe this? And the answer is only with the help of intellectuals. Now, how do you get the intellectuals to work for you? To this, the answer is easy. The market demand for intellectual services is not exactly high and stable. Intellectuals would be at the mercy of the fleeting values of the masses, and the masses are typically uninterested in intellectual philosophical concerns. The state, on the other hand, can accommodate the intellectuals, typically highly overflated egos, and offer them a warm, secure, and permanent berth in its apparatus. However, it is not sufficient that you employ just some intellectuals. You must essentially employ them all, even the ones who work in areas far removed from those that you are primarily concerned with. That is, philosophy, the social sciences, and the humanities. For the natural sciences, for instance, can obviously, it is thus important that you secure also their loyalty to the state. Or put differently, you must become among the natural sciences, for instance, can obviously think for themselves and so can become potentially dangerous also. It is thus important that you secure also their loyalty to the state. Or put differently, you must become a monopolist And this is best achieved if all educational institutions, from kindergarten to universities, are brought under direct or indirect state control, and all teaching and research personnel is state-certified personnel. Mm-hmm. But what if people do not want to become educated? For this, education must be made compulsory. And in order to subject the people to state-controlled education for as long as possible, everyone must be declared equally educable. The intellectuals, of course, know such egalitarianism to be completely false. Yet to proclaim such nonsense as everyone is a potential Einstein if only given sufficient educational attention pleases the masses and, in turn, provides an almost limitless demand for intellectual services. None of all this guarantees, of course, correct status thinking. It certainly helps, however, in reaching the correct status conclusion if one realizes that without the state, one might be out of work and may have to try one's hands at the mechanics of gas pump operation instead of concerning oneself with such pressing problems as alienation, equity, exploitation, the deconstruction of gender and sex roles, or the culture of the Eskimos, the Hopi, and the Zulus. In any case, even if intellectuals feel underappreciated by you, that is, by one particular state administration, they know that help can only come from another state administration, but not from an intellectual assault on the institution of the state as such. Hence, it is hardly surprising that, as a matter of fact, the overwhelming majority of contemporary intellectuals, including most conservative or so-called free market intellectuals, are fundamentally and philosophically statists. Now, has the work of the intellectuals paid off for the state? I would think so. If asked, for instance, whether the institution of the state is necessary, I do not think it is an exaggeration to say that 99% of all people would unhesitatingly say yes. And yet, as I will show, this success rests on rather shaky grounds, and the entire status edifice can be brought down if only the work of the intellectuals is countered by the work of intellectual anti-intellectuals, as I like to call them. The overwhelming majority of state supporters are not philosophical statists. That is, because they have thought about the matter. Most people do not think much about anything philosophical. They go about their daily lives, and that is it. So most support stems from the mere fact that a state does exist and has always existed as far as one can remember, and that is typically not farther away than one's own life. That is, the greatest achievement of the statist intellectuals is the mere fact that they have cultivated the masses' natural intellectual laziness or incapacity and never allow for the subject to come up for serious discussion at all. The state is considered an unquestionable part of the social fabric. The first and foremost task of the intellectual anti-intellectuals then is to counter this dogmatic slumber of the masses by offering a precise definition of the state as I have tried to give to you at the beginning, and then to ask if there is not something truly remarkable, odd, strange, awkward, ridiculous, indeed ludicrous about an institution such as this that decides even in conflicts involving itself who is right and wrong. I'm confident that such simple definitional work will produce some very first but serious doubt regarding an institution that one previously had been taken for granted, and that is certainly a good start. Further, and now I proceed from less sophisticated but interestingly more popular pro-state arguments to the more sophisticated but typically less popular ones. To the extent that intellectuals have deemed it necessary to argue in favor of a state at all, their most popular argument, encountered already at kindergarten age, runs something like this. Some activities of the state are pointed out. The state builds roads, kindergartens, schools, and delivers the mail and puts the policeman on the street. Imagine there would be no state. Then we would not have these goods. Thus, the state is necessary. That's the kindergarten argument. At the university level, a slightly more sophisticated version of the same argument is presented. It goes roughly like this. True, markets are best at providing many or even most things. But there are other goods. Market cannot or cannot provide insufficient quantity or quality. These other so-called public goods are goods which bestow benefits on people beyond those who have actually produced or paid for them. And foremost among such goods, such public goods, ranks typically education and research. Education and research, for instance, it is argued, are extremely valuable goods. It would be nice. They would be underproduced, however, because of free riders or of cheaters who benefit from educated people surrounding them, so to speak, via so-called neighborhood effects, without actually paying for these goods themselves. Thus, the state is necessary to provide otherwise underproduced or entirely unproduced public goods, such as research and education. Now, these status arguments can be refuted by a combination of three fundamental insights. First, as for the kindergarten argument, it does not follow from the fact that the state provides roads and schools that only the state can provide such goods. People have little difficulty recognizing that this is a fallacy. From the fact that monkeys can ride bikes, it does not follow that only monkeys can ride bikes. And second, and immediately following, it must be recalled that the state is an institution that can legislate and that can tax. And hence, that a state agency has very little incentive to produce efficiently. State roads and schools will only be more costly and their quality will be lower. For there is always a tendency for state agents to use up as many resources as possible doing whatever it is that they do, but actually work as little as possible doing it. Third, as for the more sophisticated status argument, it involves the same fallacy encountered already at the kindergarten level. For even if one were to grant the rest of the argument, it is still a fallacy to conclude from the fact that states provide public goods that only states can do so. More importantly, however, it must be pointed out that the entire argument demonstrates a total ignorance of the most fundamental fact of human life, namely scarcity. True, markets will not provide for all desirable things. There are always unsatisfied wants, as long as we do not inhabit the Garden of Eden. But to bring such unproduced goods into existence, scarce resources must be expended, which consequently can no longer be used to produce other, likewise, desirable things. Whether public goods exist next to private ones does not matter in this regard. The fact of scarcity remains unchanged. More public goods can come only at the expense of less private goods. Yet what needs to be demonstrated, of course, is that one good is more important and valuable than another one. This is what is meant by economizing. Yet can the state help economize scarce resources? And this question has to be answered. In fact, however, conclusive proof exists that the state does not and cannot economize. For in order to produce anything, the state must resort to taxation or to legislation, which demonstrates irrefutably, since taxes are not paid voluntarily, that its subjects do not want what the state produces, but prefer instead something else as more important. Rather than economize, the state can only redistribute. It can produce more of what it wants and less of what voluntary paying consumers want. And to recall, whatever the state then produces will be produced inefficiently because of the incentive structure that I mentioned before. Finally, the most sophisticated argument in favor of the state must be briefly examined. From Hobbes on down, this argument has been repeated endlessly. It runs something like this. In the state of nature, that is, before the establishment of the state, permanent conflict reigns. Everyone claims the right of everything, and this will result in interminable war. There is no way out of this predicament by means of agreement, for who would enforce these agreements? Whenever the situation appeared advantageous, one or both parties would break this agreement. Hence, that's what the argument was, people recognize that there is but one solution to the desideratum of peace, namely the establishment per agreement of a state, that is, a third independent party as ultimate judge and enforcer. Now, but if this thesis is correct, and agreements require an outside enforcer to make them binding, then a state by agreement can never come into existence. For in order to enforce the very same agreement, the very agreement which is to result in the formation of a state, that is, to make this agreement binding, another outside enforcer, another prior state, would already have to exist. And in order for this prior state to have come into existence, yet another, still earlier state must have been postulated, and so on, in an infinite regress. This is not how state formation can be explained. On the other hand, if we accept that states exist, and of course they do, then this very fact contradicts the Hobbesian story. The state itself has come into existence without any outside enforcer. Presumably, at the time of this alleged agreement, we agreed with the state, no prior state has existed. Moreover, once the state by agreement is in existence, the resulting social order still remains the self-enforcing one. To which, to be sure, if A and B, two individuals, now agree on something, their agreements are made binding by an external party, the state. However, the state itself is not so bound by any outside enforcement. There exists no external third party insofar as conflicts between state agents and state subjects are concerned. There is no third party that decides who is right and who is wrong. The state itself decides, and decides of what that it is always right. And the same is true for conflicts that might arise between different state agents. One state agency has a conflict with another. There is also no external third party to decide who is right and who is wrong in this case. So insofar as agreements entered into by the state vis-a-vis its citizens, or one state agency vis-a-vis another state agency are concerned, that is, such agreements can only be self-binding on the state. The state is bound by nothing except its own self-accepted and enforced rules. That is, the constraints that imposes it on itself. Vis-a-vis itself, so to speak, the state is still in a natural state of anarchy characterized by self-rule and enforcement because there is no higher state which could bind it. If, on the other hand, we accept the Hobbesian idea that the enforcement of mutually agreed upon rules does require some independent third party, this would actually rule out the establishment of any state. In fact, it would constitute a conclusive argument against the institution of the state, that is, of a monopolist of ultimate decision-making and arbitration. For them, there must also exist an independent third party to decide in every case of conflict between me, a private citizen, and some state agent. And likewise, there must be an independent third party in existence for every case of intrastate conflicts. And in addition, there must be another independent third party for the case of conflicts between various different third parties. Yet all this means is, of course, that such a state and or any independent third party would be no state as I have initially defined it, but simply would be one of many freely competing third party conflict arbitration agencies. Now let me conclude then that the intellectual case against the state seems to me rather easy and straightforward. But that does not mean that it is practically easy. Indeed, almost everyone is convinced that the state is the necessary institution for the very reasons that I have indicated and the weakness of which I have just tried to illustrate. So it is very doubtful if the battle against statism can be won as easy as it might seem on a purely intellectual level. But even if that should turn out to be possible, at least let us have some fun at the expense of our status opponents. And for that, I suggest that you always and persistently in your discussions with opponents confront them with the following riddle. Assume a small group of people, small attempts, who are waiting for the ability of conflicts that can work out. And now propose a solution to this eternal human problem that there will be always conflicts among them. Then he proposes as a solution to this problem that he or someone be made the ultimate arbiter in any case of conflicts, including all those conflicts in which he himself is involved or which he himself provokes. I'm confident that he will be considered either as a joker or as mentally unstable. And yet, nothing else do all statists propose. Thank you.